ears of people and things hearing my voice. I am Gary, and this is I'll Have a Beer and Talk, a podcast where I choose a random craft beer, do a little review of it, then proceed to talk about technology, science, funny animal stories, while I drink the beer. It's not quite a beer show, not quite a news show, not anything even remotely resembling a comedy show, but a bizarre amalgam of the three. Welcome to my world of childlike bemusement and wonder. I'm doing jazz hands, but you can't see. Sorry about the late show posting last week. I had a full schedule of papermaking work and social activities over that weekend, and had intended to post the show on Monday, but forgot to actually link the recorded file to the posting that I put up on Monday. Tuesday morning, friend of the show and sponsor, Tom Curley of CurleySound.com, that is CurleySound.com, let me know that the show wasn't there, so I probably fixed the recording link and got the show up on Tuesday. I promise I won't make the same mistake this week, although I'm posting it on Monday. Well, now that I'm done with that inside baseball moment, let's have a beer. And it just so happens that I have one right here next to me. It's so convenient. I have Great Divide Brewing Company's Claymore Scotch Ale, a 7.7% ABV Scotch Ale, which is not to be confused with a Scottish ale, because they are two distinct types of beer. Scotch ales are also known by their much cooler name, the Wee Heavy. Scotch ales undergo a longer boil in the kettle during the brewing process, which caramelizes the wort, making the beer sweeter and full-bodied, and giving it a high alcohol content and pronounced malty caramel and roasted malt flavor, according to BeerAdvocate.com. I am 1/16th pure Scottish, so of course I am going to enjoy this. Here comes the beer, Mike. Oh boy, it's very dark and it smells quite sweet. Let's see if it is equally as sweet in my mouth. Oh, that's the kind of beer you just want to kind of sink into and disappear into a great black hole of beautiful flavor. Delicious. In my youth, I worked at two courier companies, mostly moving freight around loading docks and on and off of aircraft, but I also drove a delivery route for a few months. Road life is actually pretty fun. You get to be out all day while people with real jobs are stuck inside, and you get to drive vehicles you don't own that get maintained by someone else, so you can floor them and slam on the brakes with abandon. It's a lot of fun. However, those jobs are a dying breed, as robots are pretty much going to take over all delivery jobs. Starship Technologies, the company that makes and sells little six-wheeled autonomous delivery robots that drive on sidewalks, who I've talked about a few times before, have just revealed a refinement for their delivery business model. According to Slash Gear, Starship Technologies has partnered with auto manufacturer Mercedes-Benz to develop RoboVan, part van, part machine, all courier. RoboVan is a sprinter delivery van that has been modified to be a sort of mothership for up to 8 of the 6-wheeled sidewalk bots. The van would drive to a delivery area, release the bots to make their individual deliveries, then collect the bots and move on to the next delivery destination. CEO of Starship Technologies, Ati Hainla, made this statement on the concept. Starship Technologies has solved the last mile problem by introducing sidewalk delivery robots. However, vans are best suited to bring goods to the local area from businesses and distribution centers. When the two transportation methods converge into one, the outcome is the most efficient, cost-effective, and convenient local delivery method in the world. The company also claims that up to 400 packages can be delivered in a single 9-hour shift with this system, as opposed to the current human-only van delivery system, which maxes out at about 180 deliveries every 9 hours. RoboVan still requires a human slave to refill the sidewalk bots with delivery cargo after each stop, so at least there's some human job security in there. Until someone develops reliable humanoid robots. Oh well. See you on the dole queue. Anytime I read about autonomous delivery of goods, I just have to ask, where's my burrito? My most eagerly awaited future delivery service, that of ordering a burrito online and having it be delivered by a robot, thereby avoiding all human contact and receiving the most perfect food form in human history, is totally happening in my lifetime. Engadget reports that, according to Bloomberg, Alphabet Inc., the parent company of our Lord Google, and most of the time very tasty and safe to eat Mexican fast casual food chain Chipotle, have begun trials of flying drone burrito deliveries. The trials are being run on the Virginia Tech campus in Blacksburg, Virginia, using Alphabet's Project Wing drones, making deliveries from a Chipotle food truck on the grounds of the school to the very lucky Virginia Tech employees and student volunteers. The Project Wing drones resemble the flying wing design of the B-2 stealth bomber, although not quite as large. Once loaded with a burrito and given a destination, they autonomously take off vertically from a standing position, cruise horizontally like a regular aircraft, then hover vertically at the delivery spot, lowering its delicious payload from the skies via a winch. Engineers will be collecting information from multiple data points during the tests, such as how the drone's navigation system performs and how well the burrito survives its trip. The data will be provided to the Federal Aviation Administration in hopes that it will help the FAA develop new rules for the future of deliveries via flying drones. Just make some rules for burrito deliveries, FAA. I'm starving. As you should know, your human tongue is capable of sensing 5 distinct flavors. But what would you say if I told you that there may be a 6th sense? No, it's not the taste of dead Bruce Willis, but is in fact starch, according to a story I read on CNN, of all places. Currently, scientists agree that the human tongue can taste 5 distinct flavor elements: sweetness, sourness, saltiness, bitterness, and my favorite, umami, also known as savory. Joyun Lim of Oregon State University's Department of Food Science and Technology was the lead author of a small study recently published in the journal Chemical Senses, which posits that the reason we humans love foods heavy in carbohydrates is because we can taste the starchiness, and we actively seek it out. It has been assumed that humans can only taste carbohydrates made of simple sugars and can't really taste starch. So in the study, a group of about 100 adult participants took part in 5 separate experiments. They were tasked with tasting several liquid solutions with different levels of simple and complex carbohydrates, then had their tongue's sweet receptors blocked and asked to taste the liquids again. And surprise, the participants stated that they could sense a bread-like or rice-like flavor even with the blocked sweet receptors. The study seems to indicate that starch gets broken down by alpha amylase, which is an enzyme in human saliva, and is turned into glucose oligomers, which then can be tasted by starch-specific receptors. Killjoy, not associated with the study, Dr. Robert Margolsky, director and president of the Monell Chemical Senses Center, said, "It is not likely to be a 6th taste. Instead, it is probably just another version of sweet taste initiated by the taste cells that respond to sugars, non-caloric sweeteners, and sugar polymers." He does, however, admit that it is plausible that there may be a glucose oligomer receptor. Fun fact, felines do not have sweet receptors on their tongues due to a genetic mutation in earlier forms of the species that happened centuries ago. I was partially raised by cats, so that might explain why I prefer bitter-tasting things, like beer. This show is sponsored by Pulp & Deckel, Portland's only community handmade papermaking studio. Pulp & Deckel's mission is to keep the art of papermaking alive with mobile workshops, demonstrations, and by creating and selling beautiful handmade paper products. Yes, I said mobile workshops. We have a truck, and we can bring the papermaking skills to you in the near future. Browse the rotating selection of papermaking workshops, check out membership options, inquire about custom orders, take an online recycled papermaking class, and check out our progress in crafting mobile class options by visiting pulpanddeckel.com. That is pulpanddeckle.com. Last week I mentioned that Google may be revealing their new Pixel phones and other hardware this coming October 4th, and a new rumor has popped up that a favorite hardware item from the past may be returning. According to The Verge, Huawei may be reviving the Nexus 7, the 7-inch Android tablet first introduced in 2012, then upgraded with better specs in 2013, then end-of-life in 2015. My 2012 model Nexus 7 has gone completely senile even after I installed an alternative operating system, and I've been trying unsuccessfully to find a replacement for it for quite a while now, so I may be in luck. Very little is known about the possible device, which appears to have been floating around with the name Huawei 7P showing up as a trademark, which many have assumed, due to the name's similarity to the Huawei-made Nexus 6P phone, marks it as a possible Nexus device. Or Pixel device. Don't know which way they're going to go with the naming. And it will have 4 gigabytes of RAM, and that's about all that we know. It would be a bold move, as the market for tablets has kind of gone off a cliff. iPad sales are flat, or have actually dropped at this point. And since many Android phones are in the 6-inch and larger range, the need for a separate 7- to 8-inch non-phone device is going to be kind of a hard sell. You have to have a good use case scenario for needing something like that. Mine is that a tablet that size would work really well as a nighttime e-reader, and I could also use it as a podcast soundboard. I guess we'll just have to wait until October to find out if I should throw some money at the screen, so wake me up when September ends. Hey, I hope you like sci-fi stories, because I have 3 of them coming at ya. All from my favorite sci-fi blog, io9.com. In case you have been unawares, this past week was the 50th anniversary of the airing of the first episode of the original Star Trek series in 1966. In the show, creator Gene Roddenberry's wife, Majel Barrett, in addition to playing recurring character Nurse Christine Chapel, also provided the voice for the Starship Enterprise's computer. When the franchise began again in 1989 with Star Trek The Next Generation, Majel Barrett returned to play recurring character Lwaxana Troi, as well as once again providing the voice for the ship's computer. And it became the standard Starfleet computer voice for each subsequent Star Trek series and film, including the recent J.J. Abrams reboot films. Majel Barrett passed away in 2008, but her voice will be reprising the role as the computer for the upcoming CBS All Access exclusive new series Star Trek Discovery. How can she do this from beyond the grave, you might be asking? According to a tweet from the @Roddenberry Twitter account, before her death, a recording was made of Majel pronouncing all the phonetic sounds that make up every word in the English language. So, through the magic of non-speaking computers, she can be made to say anything a Starfleet officer might require from a computer. Doctor Who legend Tom Baker did a similar thing in 2006 for British Telecom. For a brief time, you could have Tom Baker's voice read out your text messages. It was as weird as it sounds. The Roddenberry tweet also implied that they have been working on a version of Barrett's iconic computer voice to be offered as an alternative voice for smartphone digital assistants, such as Siri or Google Now or Cortana. Yes, soon you will hear everyone around you desperately asking the computer to pause or end what we're all assuming is just a holodeck program and not our own awful, awful reality. You know what else started in 1966? The Batman television series, of course, starring Adam West, Burt Ward, and a cavalcade of then-current big stars. I know I've talked about this before, but to celebrate the anniversary, a new animated Batman 66 feature has been produced, starring the voices of Adam West as Batman, Burt Ward as Robin, and Julie Newmar as Catwoman, and will feature Catwoman teaming up with other Bat-villains, the Riddler, the Penguin, and the Joker. Since Frank Gorshin, Burgess Meredith, and Cesar Romero are no longer with us, I'm assuming they'll be voiced by soundalikes, and I hope they get moderately close, because I really respect those actors. Batman, Return of the Caped Crusaders, will be released digitally as well as on DVD and Blu-ray on October 6th, but in celebration of the TV series anniversary, it will have a one-day-only theatrical run on October 10th. Holy big screen bat sanity! Woo! In the late 90s, when I was a lazy 20-year-old, I spent a lot of time watching the Batman TV series. So I'm really excited to see this, and I will try to catch it in the theater. Every once in a while, I check out the image blog Daleks of the Day, which does exactly what its name implies. It posts an image of a Dalek or Daleks once a day, be it stills from Doctor Who episodes, photos of fan-made Daleks, Dalek artwork, and actually a lot of Dalek-shaped cupcakes. About 2 weeks ago, they posted a black and white image of what looked like a computer-rendered 60s-style Dalek, and had a link to a blog claiming an animated teaser trailer was posted to the BBC's YouTube account, and was taken down almost immediately, but not before someone was able to grab still images. The rumor was that the BBC had taken an audio recording of a lost Dalek episode of Doctor Who from 1966, entitled Power of the Daleks, and commissioned an animation studio to basically recreate the video portion of the episode, set to the existing audio. If you don't understand why the BBC would have audio but not video for a television series in their vaults, let me explain. Way back in the 60s, no one had any concept of home video, so the idea of keeping copies of every single program that the BBC aired just to release it on the home market and make massive profit didn't even occur to them. They'd keep recent shows for a little while, then, as storage got tight, would randomly choose a handful of recordings from each program as an example of the decade in which it was made, then they tossed the rest into an incinerator. By about the mid to late 70s, home video cassette recorders started becoming available on the open market, and it was suddenly realized that people would pay to own copies of recordings that they had already seen for free, so the BBC stopped the incineration policy. However, by the time the practice was ended, many classic British television shows had lost huge chunks of their past, including Doctor Who. 97 stories have been lost, presumably forever. So I know now you're saying, okay, that explains the video, but how do they have an audio track? Well, never underestimate the ingenuity of sci-fi fans. Lacking a way to record the visual component to re-experience television shows in the 60s, fans in the 60s would take photographs of the TV screen while the episode was on, and set up an audio recorder next to the TV speaker, recording the audio of the episodes for later playback while they looked at the photos that they took of the screen. One such recording, one of high quality, was made of Power of the Daleks by a fan, and that, combined with those telesnaps of the episode, the BBC has been able to, more or less, faithfully recreate the entire episode in animated form. The episode will be broadcast on the BBC in England, and also on BBC America in the US, close to the show's original air date 50 years ago, on Saturday, November 12th, and will be available digitally on November 14th. Daleks conquer and destroy! Daleks conquer and destroy! Daleks conquer and destroy! If you're like me, and I know I am, something has been gnawing at you at the back of your mind. Are all giraffes the same? Well, it turns out, not all giraffes are the same. In fact, there are four distinct species of giraffe, so says Gizmodo. This was definitely a surprise, said Julian Fennessy, who is not only the lead author of the study that proved there are many giraffes, recently published in the journal Current Biology, but is also the co-founder of the Giraffe Conservation Foundation. That's fun to say. Giraffe Conservation Foundation. You should say that at home. Anyway, it has been noted that giraffes seem to have different types of markings and different fuzzy head bumps, depending on the area in Africa where they hang out, with those differences first being noted way back in 1758. And 9 subspecies of giraffes were defined, but no one suspected the differences were more than skin deep. Fennessy and his colleagues wanted to take a closer look, so they partnered with German biologists to collect and analyze 190 tissue samples taken from the 9 giraffe subspecies throughout the continent of Africa over the course of 7 years. What they found out will shock you, and you won't believe what happens next. Based on the data, there are 4 distinct species of giraffe that do not breed with each other. 2 of the newly defined species, the Maasai giraffe, aka G. tippelskirschi, and the reticulated giraffe, aka G. reticulate, were previously identified as individual subspecies. And the other 2, the southern giraffe, aka Giraffa giraffa, and the northern giraffe, aka G. camelopardalis, encompass several subspecies each. The new species differentiation is actually extremely important for conservation efforts. Giraffes have, until now, been lumped together as one species, and has been considered a species of least concern by the International Union for the Conservation of Nature. With the discovery of the differences, 3 out of the 4 giraffe species have dangerously low populations, and should be considered to be on the list of threatened animals. Over the years, we've been saying, look, these animals are different, Fennessy said. If we're trying to conserve biodiversity, it's best to keep them separate. Now that we're proposing 4 new species, I think there's even more reason. I'm glad that Fennessy and his Giraffe Conservation Foundation have cleared all this up by proving, yes, not all giraffes are the same. That question has been giraffing me crazy. Hey, why did the giraffe graduate early? Because he was head and shoulders above the class. Did you hear about the race between 2 giraffes? It was neck and neck. Did you know giraffes don't do drugs? It's because they're naturally high. Sorry, couldn't resist. Puns were a significant part of my upbringing, so I just can't not take advantage of a good opportunity to just kill you with horrible, horrible puns. I am so sorry. Hey, why did giraffes take so long to apologize? Because it takes them a long time to swallow their pride. Do you like I'll Have a Beer and Talk? Wish you could help me keep making it every week? Then this is the part of the show that you really need to listen to. Yes, it's the part where I play weird music in the background and beg for money. If you are entertained and informed by I'll Have a Beer and Talk on a weekly basis, could I convince you to become my patron and give me at least $1 a month? It'd be swell if you could. It'd really help me out. And you can join the cool kids that already support me over at patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. Head on over to Patreon and throw some money at me. If you want me to do some work for you in exchange for your money, you should know that my voice is for hire. I can do voiceover work, voicemail messages, mediocre acting, bad singing, and some audio production. I could produce or co-produce and or host or co-host your podcast if you have an idea but don't quite know how to pull it off. I have some experience doing this. If you think you have a use for the best part of my body, which happens to be my voice and parts of my brain, let me know. Email me at gary@pulpanddeckle.com. That is gary@pulpanddeckle.com. Want to help the show but don't have any money? Well, you're in luck. You can help the show by rating and reviewing me on iTunes. It takes a second, and every rating makes my discoverability that much better. iTunes is the most popular destination for people to discover new podcasts, so if I have good ratings, I might show up on some kind of suggested list. And people following that suggestion might listen and be willing and able to gift me at least $1 a month at that place. Oh, what was it called? Oh yeah, it's patreon.com/ihabitradio. That is patreon.com/ihabitradio. So please help me produce this show by either paying me to do some extra work, or by getting other people to pay me. And you can say that you helped. Well, it appears that my good Scottish beer is now all gone. Well, that means it's time for me to go. Please visit ihabitradio.weebly.com to see if I put anything there. And please send feedback, story suggestions, beer recommendations to wherever you have found me. Like on Google Play Music, on iTunes, on Podomatic, on Stitcher, on Spreaker, on the Twitters and Instagram at ihabitradio, and on the Facebook at facebook.com/ihabitradio. It's time for me to go. I will see you in the future. Bye-bye!